KLOS and KLOS HD1, Los Angeles. This is the rock of Southern California. Now, shining a light on the people, organizations, and events that bring Southern Californians together. This is Spotlight on the Community with your host, Terry Ray Elmer.
Our guest this morning is Erin Rank. She is president and CEO of Habitat for Humanity in the greater Los Angeles area. We have a couple of things to talk about. We're going to be talking about the new Habitat for Humanity houses that are going up in Culver City and an event that's happening big time October 13th, the LA Builders Ball. But first, talk about Habitat in Los Angeles in general. I think when people, you know, their first thought when you say Habitat for Humanity, they go, Jimmy Carter.
That's right.
Right?
Well, yes, because he still is one of our most famous volunteers, and he's been working with us for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he and his wife build every year with Habitat somewhere in the world, and they're, you know, in their 90s now and still building.
Amazing.
I just built with them in Memphis a couple weeks ago, but Los Angeles was really honored to host them twice in 1995 and 2007. And it's kind of like winning the Olympics within Habitat. Yeah, there's a big opening ceremony. People come from 30 countries all over the world to build with the Carters. And their main goal is just to bring awareness to the fact that there is such a critical housing need in the communities where they go.
Where did they build when they were here?
They built in 1995 in Watts in South L.A., and then in 2007 it was again in South L.A. and in San Pedro.
Where's the most current need right now?
Well, it's throughout Los Angeles. What we see right now is that a lot of families are, you know, after the recession, while the housing prices went down, a lot of people lost their homes. But rents went up, and so a lot of families were forced to double up and triple up. And so we see, you know, a three-bedroom house where there's a family of five living in each bedroom. And so that's not uncommon in Los Angeles right now. So just the pricing has priced many working families out of the market. And so we see a pretty squeezed housing market throughout Los Angeles right now.
How do people that need housing find you, and how do you find them?
Well, it's pretty easy to find us. We have a website. We have a toll-free number, and they can reach out to us. We have an interest form on our website, or you can call. We have staff that speak many languages, and just ask about the program. Then we have information sessions and then an application process if they're interested in applying. Same with volunteers. They can go to our website, and there's a calendar. They can sign up for volunteer days.
And what projects are currently going?
We currently are building in Montebello, Inglewood, Downey, Bellflower, Long Beach, and Culver City is coming up.
I wanted to talk about Culver City. that's a project that's dear to my heart.
Yes.
How did the whole Culver City project come about?
We were working with the city on finding ways to provide affordable housing for people who lived or worked in Culver City or in that surrounding community, because they realized that their housing prices have gone up dramatically over the last 10 years, and that a lot of people who work in that area are not able to live in that area. And so they have long commutes to work. And so they wanted to find ways to provide affordable home ownership opportunities to families in that area. They'd already been providing affordable rental units, but they wanted to provide home ownership.
And it's hard right now in Culver City, too, because it's booming so much.
It's booming, yes. It's an exciting place to live, right, and to work.
Yes, but like you said, the rents have gone sky high.
Right, the rents have gone sky high, and you still have a lot of families who are working one and two jobs, you know, but they're making, you know, an average Habitat family of four would make about $50,000 a year. So that's a good job and good pay, but it's not enough to qualify for a house in most of Los Angeles County, right?
Right. And then if you have to head out further and further out, and then you're that much further away from your job, it's costing you that much to commute. People say, well, you know, if you can't afford to live here, then go live out there. But that's not usually as feasible as one would think.
If everybody worked and lived where they could afford, then you would have a crisis of a lot of unfilled jobs, right, in the more expensive areas. And so, yes, they could live in San Bernardino, but then their commute costs are higher, their daycare costs are higher. Their time with their family is dramatically decreased, and so it really does impact the family.
Where is the Culver City project?
The Culver City project is has been approved by City Council, and the funding is in place, and we're going through the permitting process, and we hope to break ground just in early 2017.
And where is it?
Oh, it's right around Washington and the 405 freeway.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when would you say the groundbreaking was going to be when?
The groundbreaking, we did have a groundbreaking already. That was before we started the permitting process. But we actually think we'll be going
in with the shovels.
In with the shovels right after the first of the year.
And you said you have enough money in that, because that was an issue, right? You ran out of money while the project was kind of being put together?
Yes. We're still looking for some home sponsorships. But what happened is when the state eliminated their housing dollars, this project, the city lost $1 million that they had allocated towards this project that went back to the state. And so we had to make up that gap. So we've been talking about it. We were on the cusp of getting ready to transfer it and start building. And then we had that big gap to make up. So we've been working on that, and we're pretty close.
Yeah, I understand the donations came in quite well, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Well, and our faith community really has supported that project very, very well.
Very well. And the ball that's coming up,
So we're very excited.
Los Angeles Builders Ball.
That's right. On October 13th, we'll be at the Beverly Wilshire, and we'll be honoring three people who have been very involved in providing affordable housing in Los Angeles. And we're excited. It's already almost sold out. The capacity is about 800 people. We had a great event last year, and we're honoring Delta Airlines because not only are they expanding in Los Angeles and they want to be the largest airline here at LAX, but also on a community level, they've committed $900,000 to build homeownership in the city of Los Angeles over 5 years. So they're a huge community partner. Trammell Crow, you know, the company's philosophy is to be very involved in the community. They're building La Plaza Village in near Olvera Street in downtown, so they're part of that revitalization. And 20% of those units are going to be affordable units. And then Mauricio Omansky, who is the CEO of the agency, which obviously they help people buy and sell very, very expensive homes in the other side of the spectrum of the market, but he has also brought a lot of awareness and funding to Habitat over the years through our partnership with Give Back Homes. And so they help raise money for homes here and even internationally in countries like Nicaragua.
And that event is coming up on October 13th. Can people still get involved?
You can still buy tickets, and you can, you know, sponsor or come on out, and you can go to our website, and we have all the information there.
What does Habitat need right now, volunteers and money? Or both?
Really, we do. We need donations. If you think about each of our sites, we generally will buy the property and get it set to a concrete foundation with city funding or some kind of public funding. But everything from the foundation to completion is through private donations. So that's we need individuals and businesses and the faith community to come alongside us and help with donations to buy the materials. And then, of course, come out and help build the houses.
That's the thing. Some people, you know, they like the idea of donating money for a project. But when you say you can come over and, you know, pound nails and do something.
Right. It's very empowering. Actually, that's how I got involved with Habitat.
Really?
Was I came out and volunteered one day. And I thought, you know, this is so impactful because, you know, like the window that I put in that day or the door that I put in that day, I mean, here it is, you know, 20 years later, and that's still there. Like, I went by and visited my first house last week, and the house still looks great. The same family's living in it. Their mortgage is almost paid off, and the work that I did is still there. So that's what's really cool about Habitat. It's very tangible. You meet the family, you know where the money's going, that's why we have a very high rating on, Charity Navigator for 5 years in a row. We've got 4 out of 4 stars because we use the money to go directly into projects and programs.
But it's also inspiring, like you said.
Yes. Yeah. It does as much for you as the volunteer as it does for the family.
It's fantastic. Thank you, Erin.
www.habitatla.org.
That is Erin Rank with Habitat for Humanity. Again, if you want to help, go to the website.
You're listening to Spotlight on the Community with Terry Ray Elmer on 95.5 KLOS.
All right. Lost in all of the endless blather about Trump and Hillary is a very, very thick ballot of ballot measures and local elections for Southern California and Los Angeles and all of California, really, including Proposition 55, which will prolong for a dozen years 2012's temporary income tax increase. And the field poll is saying that this is supported by a wide margin. To talk to us about this is the director of the field poll. It's a pleasure to welcome aboard Mark DiCamillo. Did I pronounce your name right, sir?
DiCamillo.
DiCamillo. I can do that. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Field.com, by the way, is the website. So Prop 55 would extend by a dozen years. And according to your research, it's leading 2-1 among likely voters?
It's true. What we did in the poll was we presented voters with the actual ballot label. This is the description that voters will see when they go to the polls to vote, the title and summary. And in reaction to that description, 60% said they intended to vote yes, 30% no, 10% were undecided. So I think many voters are coming to the conclusion that probably doesn't apply to me, so it's all right if you tax that other guy.
Well, that's been the problem for a long time, and this is the classic divide and conquer strategy that's worked very well for Jerry Brown in his term, is that as long as you exempt millions of people, and this is true with L.A. County, let's make the homeowners and the property owners pay taxes, but not the apartment dwellers who often are protected by rent control. It's a problem.
Well, the initiative in the summary, it basically says the income tax applies to people with earnings over $250,000. So when voters read that, whether they're a homeowner or a renter, not that many people see themselves in that income category.
Yeah, although if you actually think about it, that could be a police officer and a school teacher.
I guess, but I think our data would show that less than 10% of voters would be affected by the measure, and I think that's the explanation behind why people are supporting it.
Now, it doesn't come as a surprise that Prop 56, which is going to slap another $2 a pack onto sales taxes on cigarettes, is also drawing support, but actually not as much support as Prop 55.
Right. The cigarette tax is only getting 53% support. 40% are opposed. I think what you're seeing on this initiative is perhaps some impact of the heavy spending on the no side. There is a lot of TV and advertising already up on the no side on Prop 56. The cigarette industry has beaten back a number of previous measures to increase cigarette taxes, and we're seeing some hesitancy among voters.
There's a tremendous amount of taxes between state proposals and then local taxes on the ballot here in Los Angeles and in L.A. County and across Southern California. And a lot of folks worry that, for instance, the mayor is pushing for a transportation tax. And, you know, at a certain point when the ballot gets really long, the theory is that people just start voting no on everything because it's just too much to absorb. They can't when they're going in, and these things don't get a lot of press coverage, and it's a lot of reading and a lot of confusion, especially because a lot of times the titles of these things are misleading.
Well, I think you'll likely see more drop-off voting. That is, people picking and choosing certain ballot initiatives that they choose to vote on, and others where they choose not to even, give an opinion. I think that's likely to happen. I think things at the bottom of the ballot probably suffer a little more from voter fatigue than those at the top. And it's my understanding that the state ballot initiatives, appear before the local initiatives on the ballot.
I'm curious, and I don't know that there's any way to quantify this, so this is kind of a pop quiz, so you feel free to skip it if you want to. But is there any data on how ballot measures track with titles or without titles? In other words, because I really do believe that the titles are really misleading in many cases, and are actually part of the campaign for these things. And if the ballot measures were just by the number, I think that there'd be different results.
Well, there has to be an official description, and
right. There could be a description, but not the title. The titles are the thing that people.
Now we haven't done that. I don't have any quantifiable data that would measure something without the title. I do recall in the past testing whether the fiscal impact statement, which is also included in the short little summary, has an effect. And in many cases, especially tax proposals, it does. So we know that that has an impact, but haven't tested the title itself.
All right. I appreciate you coming on with us. Field.com is the website. Director of the Field Poll, Mark D. Camillo. Assembly Bill 1785, was signed into law by Governor Brown on Monday that significantly expands California's restrictions on the use of mobile phones behind the wheel. The bill was written by Assemblyman Bill Quirk from Hayward, and he joins us on the Newsmaker line right now to talk about it. Good morning, Assemblyman. How are you?
I'm fine this morning. How are things?
Okay. Appreciate you coming on with us. So what does your bill do?
Well, what it says is that you cannot hold the phone in your hand and interact with it. You have to mount it on the center console or on the dashboard. You can, at that point, touch it or swipe it. But you can't enter data. The reason we came up with the bill is that while it says you can't hold your phone and call, you can't hold your phone and text, it doesn't prohibit you from taking a picture or holding the phone and looking at, say, maps. What we want to do is make sure that you have the phone in a place where you can still see the road and you can do simple interactions with it, like using a map, but that you don't enter data. And the reason we had to do that is there was a court case that said, yeah, texting is prohibited, but you can do other things like take pictures or hold the phone and look at a map, et cetera. So we needed to close the loopholes in the law.
My concern with laws like this are always the same, that if they're not really enforceable, then don't we run the risk of just debasing the meaning of law if we have a bunch of laws on the book that can't be enforced? And the reason I bring that up is because I drive a lot. And like most people, I see an enormous number of people who are texting while driving and doing all the things
talking
that we're not supposed to be doing. And those laws don't appear to be enforced. So how does this do anything other than give the police another reason to pull people over?
So right now, if they see you holding the phone in your hand and you're entering data, they can't pull you over. And, well, they could pull you over, and then you could say, oh, I wasn't texting. I was just entering data in my phone to use the map. What this says is you can't hold the phone in your hand and interact with it. That gives them a clear, bright line so that they can enforce the law.
Okay. I guess most people... You know, if you're high up and you're in a truck, you can see what's going on in the car. But a lot of people just hold the phone out of view. I just don't know how a police officer on patrol would be able to tell that somebody was doing this.
You know, if you're taking your eyes off the road, police officer in the car can see that. Yeah. You're clearly distracted in your driving.
But that happens like 8,000 times a day just with people changing a radio station. Not from this station, of course, and not this conversation. No one would do that.
Right.
Assemblyman Quirk. But I mean, I understand the reason for it because we know all the data, all the studies that show that texting and driving is exceptionally dangerous and harrowing, frankly. I see it all the time. I can barely text and drive, but we're doing some things that make no sense to me. We're creating, for instance, Terry Ray Elmer told me that her daughter was given a ticket for texting when she was in a park.
She was looking up the directions. The car was parked.
She put the car in park and was on the side of the road parked. But because the car was running, she was given a ticket. And to me, that's just abusive. That's a perfectly reasonable and safe thing to do. You know, I guess my fear about this is that the phone has become such a tool in people's lives. It's almost hard to imagine the day when we were stuck in this hideous gridlock and we didn't have the phone. But it's a tool of utility that has almost become, mandatory in modern life, especially here in Southern California, where we spend most of our lives stuck in hideous gridlock. that people just use the phone for life and for work in particular, and that, you know, that you can get, you know, I don't know. I don't know if this, you know, for whatever the safety benefit of it, I'm worried about the civil liberty benefit of it.
Well, I think we always have to be worried about laws being applied in a discriminatory way. And that's true of any law. I will say this. The point here is you can still use the phone for maps, et cetera. You just have to have it mounted. You can still interact with it. We were careful that organizations like Uber and Lyft that'll do, for example, someone will typically in those organizations, they already have the phone mounted. They can do a touch to accept that they want to take this particular driver. They can do a swipe. You can do on the order of things that you could still do with your air conditioning or changing your radio station.
This is the so-called
pushing a button,
the one tap feature.
One swipe.
One tap, one swipe.
Yeah. You can still do that. But what you can't do is tap, 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 tap.
Yeah, of course, that's how you enter to use
the address.
For your GPS system, that's how you enter the address you're going to.
Yeah, and by the way, if somebody's parked, this is definitely not what the law was meant to do.
Well, why don't we fix that? I mean, why don't you take this on and be our champion, Assemblyman Bill Quirk? Why don't you introduce a piece of legislation to decriminalize so that police can't be writing tickets for people who are parked, who did the right thing, who pulled over? You know, we say that a lot of times when we're talking to people on the cell phone while driving and say, you know, don't dial the station, don't call us while you're driving. You want people to use it responsibly.
Okay, and so you're not allowed to use your phone. You're not supposed to enter addresses into Waze while you're driving, even if the phone is mounted. But is there a law against, I got the phone on the left side and I got the GPS in the middle, so I can do the GPS, but I can't touch the phone.
I'm not quite sure I visualize what you're talking about.
My navigation system. I can use that while I'm driving. There's no law against that, right? But I can't enter directions on my phone.
Well, you can enter directions if you park or if you put them in before you start.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, in a modern car, they don't allow you to enter directions in the GPS in a car while the car is moving.
All right. Well, you know, it's the law of the land when it kicks in January 1st.
Yes.
And the first infraction is a $20 fine. Then the penalties go to $50 for each subsequent offense. We'll see how it plays out. But again, I still am gravely concerned that we've passed another law that's frankly unenforceable and just creates less confidence in law enforcement. Just less confidence in law.
You're listening to Spotlight on the Community with Terry Ray Elmer on 95.5 KLOS.
On the next Frosty, Heidi, and Frank.
Coming up on the Monday edition of the Frosty, Heidi, and Frank show. Normally, Christian Hand joins us at 9 o'clock on Mondays to break down rock music for us. But he has moved to 8 o'clock on Monday morning, so you won't want to miss that. Also, have some Alice in Chains tickets to give away Tuesday at the Wiltern and Wednesday at the Fox Theater. They'll be performing live. So be sure and listen Monday for your chance to win.
Frosty, Heidi, and Frank. Weekday mornings 5:30 to 9:30 on the Rock of Southern California, 95.5 KLOS.
Introducing your favorite breakfast.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. What do you think you're doing?
Introducing McDonald's.
There's nothing to introduce. It's not new. It's a classic. They eat it for breakfast, lunch, or dinner now. It's the most popular McDonald's breakfast sandwich in SoCal. Sausage, cheese, egg, all on a toasted English muffin with real butter. Sausage McMuffin with egg. And for $3.99, grab two anytime.
Price and participation may vary. McDonald's all-day breakfast varies by location. Price of single item posted on the menu board.
Zip.
Zero.
Zilch.
No cash down. No payments. And no interest till next year at Riverside and Huntington Beach Harley. Ride out on a brand new Harley with zero down, zero interest, and zero payments till next year. Access to California's largest inventory with over 1,000 bikes. Zero down, zero interest, and zero payments on all new Harleys at Riverside and Huntington Beach Harley. Good credit, bad credit, no credit. 100% of credit applications considered. No cash down, no payments, and no interest till next year at Riverside and Huntington Beach Harley. Now through Sunday. No payments for 120 days, no interest for 90 days with approved credit.
Hey, Paul, upgrade season's here. I got my new iPhone 7 from Sprint.
So, Pete, you upgraded your phone and your carrier. Smart.
Sprint? I've been hearing good things about their network.
Yes, Joey, all networks are within 1% reliability of each other now. And Sprint saves you 50% on most current national carrier rates.
Switch to Sprint and get the new iPhone 7. Plus, save 50% off most current national carrier rates. Don't let a 1% difference cost you twice as much. Visit a Sprint store, sprint.com/iPhone, or call 1-800-SPRINT-1 today.
50% savings until 5/31/18 after pay full amount. Subject to $30 activation fee, credit and valid porting. Must choose from porting carrier rates. Applies to Verizon Plan 2, 4, 8, 16, 24, 30, 40, and 50 gigabytes. AT&T Mobile Share Advantage. 1, 3, 6, 10, 16, 25, 30, 40, 50 gigabytes. T-Mobile Simple Choice 2, 6, 10 gigabytes. Carrier and international features differ. Plans exclude unlimited music and video streaming, data carryover, and cloud options that other carriers' plans may offer. See website for eligible plans. Reliability claim based on third-party data. Offer coverage not available everywhere. Restrictions apply.
95.5. Now, back to Spotlight on the Community with Terry Ray Elmer.
Shining Light is a charity organization founded in memory of Dolores Rojas by her granddaughter just this past March. Dolores lived her life in service to the community. She began losing her vision when she was in the 80s and was completely blind at the age of 86, still kept a positive attitude and always found new ways to help the community. She passed away this January. And in her honor, again, her grandchildren and other family members have founded what's called Shining Light After Dark. Crystal Mercado with the organization joins us this morning. Good morning, Crystal.
Good morning.
Tell us about Shining Light After Dark.
Okay, Shining Light After Dark, like you said, it's a nonprofit organization. And what we do is we help senior citizens that are blind and legally blind get equipment or items that would help make their everyday life easier.
Mm-hmm. Like,
for example, so far some of the people we've helped really needed walkers with seats, wheelchairs, even simple things such as a shower chair or a recorder to record notes and pretty much anything they would need that would help them with their everyday life.
And how did the granddaughter come to this idea to come up with this charity?
Well, I'm the granddaughter.
Oh, you're the granddaughter. Oh, my gosh. Okay, tell us about your grandmother then.
Okay, so my grandma, like you said, Dolores B. Rojas, I founded it in her memory. Mm-hmm. She was very, very active in our community. She was constantly volunteering at HIV AIDS centers, after school programs, youth programs, Boys and Girls Club. So even some of my early memories, I remember her taking myself and my sister with her mm-hmm. to go volunteer. So it kind of was embedded in our lifestyle mm-hmm. since we were children. And we would always go with her to the Boys and Girls Clubs and different places. So growing up, it was in our lifestyle. And as she got older, she started to, her vision started to diminish.
Was that hard for you?
Yes, it was really hard for us and our family and finding ways for her to still have independence and freedom. It was always hard for us to find things for her to do and places for her to go, mm-hmm. us to take her. So she's not just at home. It was really challenging for us to get her even around the house, and I was her caretaker, so it wasn't it wasn't really easy for us to find ways to have her get around just by feel.
Well, yeah, and it's difficult enough to be elderly. To be elderly and blind has got to be just awful.
Exactly, yes.
So what are you looking for, Crystal? Tell us about how Shining Light After Dark is going to help people.
Okay. So what we do is we have, we started this sponsorship part of our organization. So what we do is we find sponsors to pretty much sponsor a senior in need.
Mm-hmm.
And the items that are requested from seniors vary. Every family is
different.
Yeah,
what different. Do they
want? Yeah,
what
every
do they
family
need?
Is different. So one of the gentlemen that we helped out, he just wanted a recorder to record simple notes. Because him, unlike us, he can't take notes, put it on a post-it or anything.
And say,
like,
oh,
that.
I need to remember that.
Exactly. So he wanted a recorder to record his personal notes and, you know, to remind him. So we got him that. Shower chairs. We had a lady who had a kidney transplant. So kidney transplant, blind. She needed a commode. We were able to provide her with that. Wheelchairs, walkers, because we do help legally blind senior citizens as well. So you don't have to be completely blind. But as long as you're legally blind, we'll be able to help you as well.
How do you find the people?
So we found a lot through senior centers, family, friends. There's actually a lot of people around that, you know, are in such need of help. And even the little items like shower chairs, walkers, are able to really be life-changing for them.
Yeah, and not a huge investment on anyone's part.
Exactly, exactly.
And do you help also with things like taking them places, getting them to doctor's appointments and stuff?
We're not there yet.
You're going to.
Because, yeah, we're still new. We're working out, and we're still developing.
Mm-hmm.
Since we just started in March of this year, we're kind of just at our beginning stages.
Right.
So we're still kind of branching out, but we do have also Sacramento County that we're working with, too.
Interesting.
Yeah, so we're slowly branching out, and we have different ways of helping seniors. Like, even we do have junior sponsors. So for small items like as quad canes, recorders, mm-hmm. what we do is we're able to have a child save up their, chore money,
right.
and allowance, and be able to sponsor a senior. So what we have them do is we'll see what they have, like, put aside. If they have maybe $30, we'll see what fits in that category. We're able to buy them, like, a quad cane or a recorder, anything that would fit in the category. And then they'll receive, like, a thank you card from their sponsor. Uh-huh. With the approval of the sponsor, which they're usually really open and really, really grateful for the item that they had, because they're on fixed incomes and they can't always afford simple items.
Right.
So they're always really excited to share their history or give them a picture of thank you. So we'll give you a thank you card or a letter with fun facts to the kids about the seniors. For one senior, he turned blind in his older years, but he was a pilot and a very successful businessman. So he was so happy to, you know, share with the kids that, you know, I was just like your grandparents, and something so small like this can help me so much, you know? So the kids love it.
Well, and you're inspiring kids the way your grandmother did you, right?
Oh, that's right. I didn't even think about that.
Okay, how does one become a sponsor?
Okay, so to become a sponsor, it's really simple. We do have our website we're developing. It's www.shininglightafterdark.org. And you can go email us there. And you could always call us. We have LA area, also to Sacramento County
mm-hmm.
phone number as well. And you call us and just let us know a little bit about what you're looking, what is in your budget, and we'll definitely make it fit. 100% of that donation would go directly to your senior. We'll be able to provide you with a receipt, a card, and anything that you need that would help. Some people like to go deliver the item with the senior.
Right.
And we're able to let that happen as well.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And if people know someone who needs the help, same website, same thing?
Yes, definitely. So we're also looking for people that are in need of our help as well. Legally blind, like I said, and blind as well.
And again, the website is?
www.shininglightafterdark.org.
Thank you, Crystal. Crystal Mercado with Shining Light After Dark. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Spotlight on the Community with Terry Ray Elmer on 95.5 KLOS.
So we have covered the digital revolution almost in real time. It's changed the way we do the show and live our lives. But I remember, I'm paraphrasing now, but Bill Gates a few years ago said, and again, this is paraphrasing, not a quote, that the politicians, our leaders, have no idea what's about to come down upon them. And he was talking about the digital revolution that is eliminating entire categories of work. And while it undoubtedly has created new areas of work, basically for every job it's adding, it may be taking three. The latest is self-driving vehicles and specifically self-driving trucks. We had Jim Hoffa on, the son of Jimmy Hoffa and the head of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, last week. And when I asked him about what the Teamsters Union's prep was for the inevitability of self-driving vehicles, he simply said, it's not going to happen.
He didn't want to hear about it.
It's not going to happen. It is happening. Freightliner, Volvo, Mercedes-Benz, all the big developers have trucks. You can go online and watch video of trucks driving themselves on roads and parking themselves, parallel parking themselves, backing into loading docks. So what's going to happen to the 4.1 million people who drive for a living? That's just one of many questions. Let's get the answers. The author of Artificial Intelligence, What Everybody Needs to Know. It's a pleasure to welcome the fellow at Stanford Center for Legal Informatics, Jerry Kaplan. Jerry, welcome aboard. How are you?
Good. Thanks very much. Pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, the book is called, by the way, Humans Need Not Apply, as well as And Artificial Intelligence, What Everybody Needs to Know. So, look, the technology is miraculous. It's incredible. I'm actually about a third of the way through a new biography of Marconi. I figured after all these years in radio, I'd understand what Marconi actually did. And certainly the telegraph people, the transatlantic cable people, weren't that happy about wireless. So every new technology can displace somebody. But it seems like what's happening now is eliminating entire categories of work. And there's really no answer to what we do with the people that are displaced in many cases.
Well, I think that's true, but it's simply a question of retraining people. I think the answer isn't let's stop the
no, you can't
tide
stop
of change
it.
From coming.
You can't stop it. I mean, it's if you build a better mousetrap, people are going to go for the better mousetrap. Now, the other half of that is you get smarter mice, and I don't know that that's the case. If you're a 48-year-old machinist and the machine shop closes, what are you retrained to do, and how do you live while being retrained while you got a wife and three kids?
Well, these are very important social policy questions that our politicians need to consider. I think the real issue is that the old model of the way you engaged in some profession was you went to school, you learned a trade, and you did that for the rest of your life. But given the pace at which technology is changing the labor force, I think we would be much better served with systems that permit us to get retrained every 5 or 10 years. To learn new skills that will allow us to perform the jobs that are most valuable.
In theory, I totally get that. But in reality, not everybody's capable of this. And that's my concern. Our oldest son is a technologist, and he goes to South by Southwest. He goes to all the places that have technology shows. And he's gone from, you know, he has wild enthusiasm and amazement at the science. But he's now started to have grave concerns. You know, they I'm sure you know this, Jerry. They make a robotic arm that could be placed next to a subassembly worker, and it sort of very quickly mimics the motions of the human hand, and then you can remove the human hand, and the robotic arm will do that work 24/7 without any sick days or calling in drunk or anything forever. But what about that person?
Well, again, it's just a question of having to retrain that person. If you go back and you look throughout history, you see this pattern recurring all the time. There's nothing new about it. But we seem to be attached to the current set of professions. You know, when I was a kid, a milkman used to come and deliver the milk because we didn't have, I guess they didn't have good enough refrigerators back then. 20, 30 years ago, if you wanted to make a phone call, there were, I think, a million operators in the U.S. that would connect your calls. That was more than 30 years ago. And now there's a small fraction of that. Maybe 1% of those are still jobs. I don't think anybody wants to roll back the clock on these things, but we do need ways to retrain people. And there is hope on that front, too, because now there are all kinds of new companies that are developing in the education space that are developing specialized certifications where you can learn specific skills that are valuable for new jobs, and people are using these to retrain themselves very effectively.
But I guess I know that that does happen, but I'm looking at, you know, we're having a conversation again, not a very bright one, but a conversation during his campaign about the Rust Belt America, about, you know, and we've been for 30 years, for 40 years, we've been having politicians promise that they're going to bring jobs back to the Rust Belt, and no one's done it successfully. Some cities have rebuilt themselves and recreated. Lowell, Massachusetts is one that comes to mind. Pittsburgh is one that comes to mind that's having a resurgence. But for every Pittsburgh, there's still a Buffalo or a Utica, New York, or San Bernardino, California, for that matter. And there's a lot of displacement. And again, there doesn't seem to be, because the technology is happening so fast, the transference from the agrarian age to the Industrial Revolution played out over a very long period of time, whereas the Digital Revolution has mushroomed and state-of-the-art doesn't exist. Before something can be installed, it's obsolete. There's something that's better.
Well, the first question, you raised a lot of points in what you just said. Let me just make a few comments on it, if I could.
Yeah, please.
The first one is about the Rust Belt. Those jobs not only didn't just leave the country, they went away.
That's
most of the kind of jobs that were done there are now automated.
Right.
And the idea that you can bring them back is completely ridiculous.
I agree.
Okay, but what you can do is invest in bringing new kinds of industries to those areas and train the people who are there for the industries that may be useful for them to engage.
But I guess my concern is that the new industries employ a fraction of the people that were once employed, and we still end up with a net loss and a population that is, you know, if you're 59 years old and you find yourself out of work, you may never work again.
I dug not to argue with you, but
no, you can argue. Oh, you can argue with me.
People have been making that argument for hundreds of years. This is it. Now we're going to replace all of the buggy whip makers, and everybody's going to be out of work. But that misses the fact that consistently over that historical period, employment has increased dramatically, and the reason is very simple. Yes, you're going to put people out of, say, truck driving, which I think was the example that you were talking about. There'll probably be 1 million to 1.5 million workers displaced over a period of perhaps 20 years. But the truth is it makes everybody wealthier. And if it makes everybody wealthier, they spend money. And that increases employment in other
areas. I know you've studied it and I haven't. This is anecdotal. But I'm not experiencing this and I'm not seeing it. I'm not hearing it from people. I'm hearing from a lot of guys my age who lost their jobs and cannot get another job. They can't get, you have to apply online, and they never hear back. They get an auto response. I talked to a good friend of mine, I mean a person who's like a brother to me, who has a folder on his desktop with 700 cover letters over the last 4 years. Now, he worked for himself for 32 years, ran his own business, but the technology, he was a commercial and industrial film producer in Connecticut. And he, because everybody went in-house, the technology simply made it possible for in-house IT to do those jobs. He supported himself, owned two homes, had a good quality of life. But he's got 700 letters that were sent out with no responses.
Well, I'm meaning no disrespect to your friend. He's in a profession that changed, and he's trying to get a job that doesn't exist. I could send out 700 letters proposing to become a hat maker.
Yeah, but you're missing my point. These letters included to Home Depot. 59-year-olds are not getting hired. Nobody wants them.
Well, that's age discrimination.
But I guess, and I'm not holding you accountable for it. Trust me. but my point is that our not one word has been said about this and all the nitwit yammering that we've heard in campaign 2016. Nobody's talking about the technological component of the displacement the simple fact of the matter is that we built these giant banks. You see banks all over the place. We don't need big banks. We don't need giant banks. Nobody goes in the bank. There's five people in line in a bank. They've got these big buildings. There's nobody working there.
Well, that's true, and a lot of that's because of the introduction of the automated teller.
Yeah.
But what that's done is to change the nature of the job that tellers perform, and so different kinds of skills are needed, and different people tend to have those skills. I think what you're right about, there are two factors you're talking about. One is people don't like to hire old people like you and me. Let's face it. So I understand that. So you got to find professions where that's okay, like being a radio announcer or writing books on artificial intelligence.
Again, there's not a lot of people. If your career has been as a machinist, that you're left. You're left with no time to retrain, and you'd go broke while being retrained. I mean, I just want the conversation to be held with all the cards dealt face up. I understand the upside of the technology. I certainly understand the upside for businesses who enjoy lower labor costs. But not everybody is going to be able to make this transition, and we're seeing that, and I think that fuels so much of the anger. So many people are left behind. The book is called Artificial Intelligence, What Everybody Needs to Know. The author is Jerry Kaplan, K-A-P-L-A-N. Thanks so much for coming on. All right, ladies and gentlemen, there are, to say the least, a lot of people who are genuinely stressed out over campaign 2016. I've now kind of settled into this. I've gone through all seven stages of Kubler Ross, and I'm working on acceptance, because there's nothing we can do about it at this point. We're going to have to pick one of these people, I guess. But there are a lot of people who are really bent out of shape about it. It's called election stress disorder. And to talk to us about it right now is the author of Soar Above, How to Use the Most Profound Part of Your Brain Under Any Kind of Stress, therapist and author Dr. Stephen Stosny joins us. Dr. Stosny, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Trying to stay cool in the election.
You know, this is not scientific, but I've been in the belly of the beast for 20 years covering these campaigns and just involved in, people's responses to the world that we live in. And I really do find that people project onto our political leaders a lot of personal baggage. And I think the reality is most of what troubles us in our lives is created by us in our own lives, not in Washington or Sacramento or whatever state you live in. But we do obviously live in a world that has a government, and the government matters, and we have points of view. And this particular election has probably been the most irritating in the history of the world.
Oh, well, I agree completely with what you said. In fact, what we tend to project onto our leaders are qualities that we don't like in ourselves, and then we can really condemn them in the leaders when we project them. That's called projective identification. There's even a name for it. But the reason that I think this election is more contentious is, besides the fact that there's a lot more vitriol in it and personal attacks, is that emotions are modeled. A lot of research shows that it's the influence of movies and television. When you see people react in a certain way, you tend to mimic them. They're also very contagious. If you're around a resentful person, you will become resentful, or if you can't get away from that person. So with the 24-hour news cycle and social media and the internet trolls constantly churning up this negativity, it's creating stress that people take into their families, unfortunately.
Well, yeah, I think that that's really true. It's the ever-presence, the endless marinade in politics that we live in, the people that are into it, between 24-hour news channels, talk radio, traditional news sources, and social media particularly, allows people to get into fights with people who are ostensibly friends. I really kind of call it political cyberbullying. It's because it used to shut it off, and now there's no way to shut it off. It follows you everywhere.
That's right. It's in your phone. You can't. It's in your hand. You can't turn it off. In addition to cyberbullying, though, there's a general intolerance for anyone who disagrees with you.
Yes.
And when you take that into your family, it's really deadly, because you're not trying to understand your partner or your children. You're trying to demand submission from them, and you feel betrayed if they don't agree with you.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is happening across the board. I saw a story yesterday. The Arizona Republic, the newspaper, the Arizona Republic, endorsed Hillary Clinton. It's the first time in its 128-year history they didn't endorse the Republican nominee. And I happened to be reading some threads when that story was posted. And immediately it becomes rag, and expletive. And this is the sort of take no prisoner mantra that's circulating in the culture today. That left or right, it doesn't matter. If you stray off of this ideologically pure reservation, you are worthless. You are scum. You're some kind of fecal matter stuck to the bottom of society's shoe.
Oh, that's a great way to describe it, but that's true. The only, I call it toddler brain politics. It's splitting. You're all good, you're all bad. And if you don't agree with me, not only about a candidate, but any thought I have, then you're scum on the bottom of people's shoes.
Yeah, no, it's really true. It's I don't know if this is uniquely because of the nature of this campaign with two seriously flawed candidates, or if this is something that it's that plus this is the first election that we've had with full-blown incessant social media participation.
Nonstop.
I mean, we certainly had it in 2012. And we, but in 2012, we did not have two hate candidates as loathed as these two are.
Yes, they did the 2012 or any election. I remember the candidates didn't exploit the anger that's in the country. Anger is the most contagious of all emotions because it's survival based. If you make someone angry, they're going to make someone else angry. and it passes car by car down the highway, workstation by workstation in the workplace, and room by room in the house.
Yeah. Well, the book is called Soar Above, How to Use the Most Profound Part of Your Brain Under Any Kind of Stress. The author, Dr. Stephen Stosny, S-T-O-S-N-Y. Thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
This has been Spotlight on the Community with Terry Ray Elmer on 95.5 KLOS.